Okay, so I really appreciate the invitation to come and talk about the subject of my passion with the people, with all the computational tools of my aspiration. And so what I think from talking with Terry is my place in the overall program is kind of at this transition point from where most of the talks have been about protein structure and protein DNA interaction from a biophysical point of view, through some of the current functional genomic technologies, principally microarrays, about which I'll say only a little, toward how we hope that we'll be able to use that kind of information and other kinds of approaches to, in my jargon, put real meaning to the arrows in the diagrams that most of us biologists have spent the last 20 years generating for regulatory circuitry, most particularly focusing on that part of regulatory circuitry that concerns how much a gene will be transcribed or not transcribed. And I'll refer to a couple of model systems, but naturally talk most about one that we've worked in for the past 10 or 12 years, which is concerns a process in mammals, but which is also universal in the animal kingdom, which is the differentiation of striated muscle and how you create cells of that type and get them to turn into the final product that is muscle. So I think as a perspective, where most of us have been for a long time who are in the business of being molecular or regulatory biologists has been at the matter of what set of genes or proteins regulate and execute a process. And so although we've actually talked about doing molecular mechanism for a long time, a very large fraction of this activity has been devoted to a different level of stamp collecting, which is the most pejorative thing that people typically say about biology. And this stamp collecting is figuring out which genes affect which process and to some first approximation in what way do they affect the process. And then there's what role each plays in that process. Now, where I think there's pretty universal agreement we want to be and need to be is first at the whole genome completeness level for pathway content. And so the way in which pathways have been defined mainly using classical genetics and using molecular biochemistry has been sort of a very step-by-step, molecule-by-molecule kind of approach. And we've suffered enormously from the ignorance of incompleteness. So you know there are all these other genes out there, and you don't know which ones are also relevant to your process. And you go on trying to saturate in one way or another through biochemical interactions or through genetics to try and ultimately bring into your fold, your model, and your picture of the pathway everything that's there. But without knowing what else is out there, you rarely have the sense that you've seen it all. And so the biggest change for people like me with the advent of whole genomes is that once, as has already been done for yeast and coli and is in pretty good shape for Drosophila and is not yet in good shape for human and mouse, but will be, I think, in the foreseeable future, when you know pretty well what all the genes are and can assay them all at once, then this incompleteness business evaporates.
Don't you have the danger that the pathway will become the whole genome?
You'd only have the danger. I mean, ultimately, that's the reality. And so when we talk about a pathway or a network, one of the things that I was hoping to stimulate discussion on so that I could try to get wisdom back at the end of all of this is that when we go to simplify, one of the ways to simplify is to bound the pathway and say, okay, we've got some inputs out here and we're not going to deal with them. You know, we may know a lot about them even, but we're going to treat them as unit inputs, and we're going to look at the pathway bounded at this level, and we're going to go as far as this sort of endpoint. For example, in my case, the end of the biological pathway is the formation of differentiated skeletal muscle, and the end of the gene pathway in general is the readout of genes that probably have no regulatory feedback, but simply exist to be the protein products that make muscle. And so the myosins and the actins and the acetylcholine receptors. And while those are all wonderful things if you want to know about how muscle works in regulatory terms, that's the end of the line for me. So I think one can reasonably bound a pathway, but at the same time and at the end of the day, everything will, at some level, be connected to everything else. And you can, it's fun to talk about when the right thing to do is to bound it kinetically at a place in time, when the right thing to do is to bound it in a multicellular organism by looking in only one cell. So is that sort of get at what you're, yeah, it's definitely definite. The dynamics are something that we generally haven't dealt with in nearly as sophisticated a way as we want to, and I guess where I really hope to spend the next decade is in the kind of thing that is just beginning to happen, and Uri can tell you more about one of my favorite instances where this has been pushed to some interesting limits, and that is the modeling of bacterial chemotaxis to start asking about pathway properties and which kinds of models are more or less illuminating on properties to which the system is robust and not. That isn't a question that biologists have much asked, at least biologists of my stripe that do this regulatory biology. We're so concerned with finding something that actually does have impact that we almost never think of asking what doesn't have impact and is that really interesting. And it's been a revelation coming from the modelers and the control dynamics types to actually say, well, gee, that's a major part of what's interesting about a system is what it tolerates as opposed to what it doesn't tolerate. And given our heritage in classical genetics and biochemistry, we're so obsessed with finding anything that works that that turning the question inside out is probably not a revelation to everyone, but to most of us it is. Then there's something that I hope I have time to talk a little bit about at the end, which is the evolution of circuitry as opposed to the evolution of a particular family of molecules. And I think this is going to be a really exciting and rich area, partly for figuring out how any given circuit works by looking at the natural experiments of evolution, and partly beginning to get a handle on what it is that the great tinkerer of evolution has been able to do, starting with one pathway, and then either adding things to it, subtracting things from it, or getting it to do something else. There's one very fun case in muscle, where in the fruit fly there's a molecule that we had identified in mouse and man as a very strong negative regulator of the pathway toward muscle. And in the fruit fly, it turns up as a very strong positive regulator. And it still hasn't been unraveled because we don't know what's happening with all the genes in place, how it is that the players can be interacting to give these completely opposite effects. And in Drosophila, it's all pretty well pared down so that there's, in this case, there's only one gene of its type. I'm tempted to diverge out into one of the issues we have to deal with in mammals, which is pseudo-redundancy, but I'm going to not diverge yet to that. So I guess that emphasis on completeness that's replacing one-off studies brings me to think that a useful thing I could do in the beginning here is to point out some of the unevenness in the way that we can monitor what each one of the systems in the central dogma is doing. And some of this, I think, is where we're in good shape, is probably obvious. At the DNA level, as the genomes get more and more complete, things are pretty good. At the level of monitoring the entire transcriptome, which is, you've been listening to talks on gene chips and clustering for hours this week, I think, if I looked at the website and interpreted it correctly. And so in that area, we're also in pretty good shape. I mean, there are a lot of things that I think are working with the systems are unfortunate deficits. It is at best semi-quantitative, and in many of the types of data that we deal with, one's got a better handle on the ratio of one what's going on in one sample to another sample than on the absolute amounts, and that's actually a gigantic step backward. So in order to get the completeness offered by the chips, we're actually sacrificing the level of precision and accuracy with which we could measure what the output of any given gene is. And I hope that doesn't last forever. And we can have hallway conversations about technologies that one might hope will replace the chips at some point in the not-too-distant future or are doing so. It's also not okay for single cells. So there are a lot of problems that you're aware of now or that I know people are going to talk about in the next couple of weeks, just knowing roughly what they do, where the issue of can you get single cell readout and can you get it over time frame This is where monitoring single cells and even in the best case single molecules with systems like green fluorescent protein have been so incredibly valuable, but there's still something that's being used in a small fraction of experiments. So when you start averaging over populations, all kinds of good things become invisible. Monitoring the entire proteome has been something that has been much discussed and much done at the level of gel-based technologies. And there are still large operations, commercial and academic, to do that. There are deep-seated and, I would assert, probably insurmountable difficulties with making gel-based systems ever deliver what you want to know, which is the amount and modification state and identity of every protein in the proteome for a given cell in a given cell state. And in order to do that, I'll just say for now, and we can talk later if people are interested, that the most promising thing that I can see on the horizon comes in several forms of mass spec. I think mass spec is really going to come into its own, and there are a few groups that are doing, for example, whole E. coli extracts, flowing in developing accurate mass tags that represent each genome. And so while you can't ever get in a triptych digest a good look at every peptide from every protein, you can, once you know a whole genome, go through and with some considerable labor, pick out an accurate mass tag that delivers well and that seems to fly well in the mass spec, and actually thereby monitor the protein from which it comes. And
what
the fan, yeah.
What about antibodies on a chip?
Yeah, antibodies on a chip, I think, are also promising. For monitoring presence, and if you are able to develop antibodies, as has been done for some pyrosine phosphorylation states, for example, you can start to get that kind of information that we really crave, which is the post-translational modification state that so often dictates activity. So I think that's promising. I guess I think that that's always destined to have many of the flaws that we're now keenly aware of from working with the gene chips. That is, the quantitation is always going to be rocky, and I think setting up those arrays and getting all those reagents, I've worked with, you know, tens or scores of different immune reagents over the years going after, and they are idiosyncratic. And even when they're monoclonal, they're idiosyncratic. And so my optimism that the chip is really going to behave nicely is very different for protein chips than it is for RNA chips. I mean, RNA and DNA are chemically really boring, and that's their great merit. That hybridization reaction, once you play with base composition and stringency, is nicely controllable. And proteins interacting with proteins, even something as good as an antibody, with all those different affinities, just makes me a little bit frightened about how uniform and how universal it will be.
I have a question on the messenger RNA readout. Not possible to grind up a single cell and PCR to multiply.
Yeah, in fact, we're into that. We'll just skip this. You've seen lots of arrays. The kind that we have the most experience with are two, the Affymetrix arrays and the kind of spotted arrays. And I'll only add two small things that may have been taken care of at great length by your speaker from Rosetta or by DeRisi. At Rosetta, they will have been talking about relatively long oligo arrays. We arrived at the conclusion about a year and a half ago, laboriously making mechanically printed oligo arrays of long oligos, that is precisely what you want to do. And I wouldn't go so far as to suggest necessarily buying stock in Rosetta because of it, but I would sure say that if the price makes it ultimately accessible to the academic community, these tools are by far the most powerful tools of the ones that we have worked with, which I think cut across all the other forms of arrays, short oligos, as in Affymetrix, cDNAs made by us, and everything in the middle. One of the things that you can do is shown in the diagram on the left, which simply establishes that if you design it correctly, you can begin to probe splice isoforms as well as probing the presence or absence of a DNA. And so you're looking at a family of regulators that are important in the muscle differentiation paradigm that I'm going to show you a little more about. And one of them, F2C, which is in the second panel down there, is a gene and a transcript that goes up in its entirety during the course of muscle differentiation. You're looking at a time course here off a chip. We've just extracted particular spots of interest. However, there is another one, the one represented down the lower right, that is a particular splice isoform of a MEF2D gene, which also is upregulated and is utterly muscle-specific, unlike any of the other MEF2s, and that's reasonably detected by this oligo that was designed to just bridge the proper join between the two exons. And so it does not react if any of the other forms of that RNA are there, and only if that one is there. And you are looking at, this has been, I think these have been, this is not a log plot. This has been turned into fold induction, and it's as a function of time, and it's fold induction over baseline. And the reason that we have done that is because almost all of the time when I show this, I'm showing it to biologists, and biologists have been looking at linear plots of fold induction over baseline for so long that if subjected to a log plot, they collapse and say, there's no signal there. And so this is an adjustment to our community standard for presentation. So you were asking about single cell, and is there, can you go after it, and how can you go after it? And one of the things that, again, I won't dwell on, but just show briefly here, is that we do think that looking at single cells for some biology is essential. And what this illustrates are experiments that one of my students did several years ago, in which she worked out a way of using PCR, and in this case a multiplex PCR, and at some considerable labor, she was able to pluck these individual cells that sit on the outside of an adult muscle fiber. And these cells are interesting to us because they're a progenitor that doesn't go forward in development, but simply lays there in wait in case you injure your muscle. And if you injure your muscle or have some kind of degenerative insult, these cells come alive out of a quiescent state. They literally puff up in size, they build a lot of ribosomes, they start synthesizing protein, they begin to divide, and they're able to, if you wipe out muscle, they're able to completely repopulate that muscle, as well as regenerate themselves. So they have some of these magical qualities of what are called stem cells that will regenerate themselves at the same time that they spin out derivatives. So they're an object for those reasons of biological interest to us. So she would go in with a pipette and pluck these cells off one by one and take them out and analyze them. And what you see on the left was our best but crude effort to date to try and make these cell states, the sum of such a study over a time course going over a period of a couple of days from 0 hours in the upper left at the initial time that the fibers are taken out through a day and 2 days and on out to 96 hours. And this is an attempt to display what's going on with six genes and to describe their states by this crude Venn diagram and the use of two different symbols. The sad technical fact is that going up beyond six or seven genes simultaneously gets you into serious PCR technical problems. And in order to get families of primers that handle the sensitivity issues, which requires nested primers, and at the same time handles the issue of not cross-reacting with each other at the concentrations they have to be used, we found out that we had pretty well pushed, we think we pretty well pushed the limits of the technology. And if one were biologically compelled and very highly motivated, you could probably simultaneously measure from the same cell maybe 10 things in this way. So there are people who have pushed the limits of amplifying, as you suggest, all the RNA in the cell and then throwing that on a chip. And I think I would say that at this time that looks somewhat promising, but I don't think I have yet seen something that convinces me that it is really robust or even moderately robust. And to do these experiments, that was the hardest thing to figure out. What kind of a control do you do to actually establish that the assay itself is robust and isn't just giving you interesting fluctuation because your sensitivity is off? And this whole issue of how many RNA molecules do you need in the cell in order to seed an efficient PCR so that you're not basically doing the Delbruck-Luria fluctuation analysis instead of measuring how much RNA is in the cell is problematic. And so using these methods that are variously derivatives of what Eberwein began to do about 10 years ago, where you put T7 and T3 RNA promoters on by PCR, and then you run it to make RNA, I think are promising, but they will never deliver. Every time you do that amplification, whether you're doing it this way or doing it that way to put it on a chip, it hurts you in the measurement. And it hurts you because of differential amplification. It hurts you because of limits of efficiency. And I would much prefer to see a method developed that just lets you look straight on with high sensitivity at what's in a cell. And I think, again, there may be multiple answers to this, but I think mass spec may be our friend in this case also. Not looking directly at the nucleic acid, but looking at mass spec tags, hybridize, and then run the tags through. That depends enormously on whose mass spec you're looking at and how much there. I mean, you can detect only a few molecules in the very best cases, but getting, and I am no mass spec expert, but when presented with this possibility and this challenge, there are people who feel that it should be possible to work from single cells if you're able to mass spec tag multiply on the same RNA. So if you imagine something where a given RNA delivers not one signal, but it multiplies up and gives you something like 10 or 20 signals, that's kind of like amplification, but without going through enzymatic steps. And so I think there may be ways to do it, but it's still going to push the limits, no question, for sensitivity. I don't want to bother with that. So what I'm going to talk about in the way of introducing regulatory networks as we experience them in multicellular organisms, I'm first going to show you the cellular pathway of what these cells do. And so we begin at the top with what's referred to as a multipotential progenitor cell. And this cell exists in embryos of humans and mice and other vertebrates all along the back of the developing embryo on either side of the neural tube in what's called the paraxial mesoderm. And this can give rise to the deep skin or dermis. These cells give rise to bone and cartilage. They give rise to fat and probably a number of other things as well. But one of the principal things that they give rise to is skeletal muscle. And in this case, all the skeletal muscle in the body derives from this original set of tissue that's on either side of the neural tube. When these cells make what developmental biologists call a determination decision or a commitment switch, and at that point, we have some molecular markers for what's going on, but what they have become is a so-called committed myoblast. And that's a cell that still has the potential to divide, but if it's going to become something rather than just remain like itself, it now seems to be committed to become skeletal muscle. It no longer seems to have the potential to take the other pathways. Now, all of these assays and that kind of thinking depends on how you've tested what its commitment is. And that's just the kind of squishy thing that's probably bound to drive you nuts, and it even drives some of us a little nuts. But it seems to be a very real phenomenon, and there are molecular correlates that I'll get to that make us think that this is a cell which by its not only what it's going to do, but by its characteristics of gene expression at this time, is fundamentally different from its progenitor, and it's taken a decision. Yeah, that's one of the classic kinds of assays that embryologists use to arrive at these kinds of ideas. But of course, all environments have not been tested, and that's why I said it's kind of a squishy sort of decision. And so if you learn enough about all the signals that might be needed to provoke it to go, say, over toward bone, and now you, instead of just putting in an environment where bone is developing, you actually play and give it large doses of all possible things that might drive something toward bone, could you get this cell to do it? In fact, there's evidence that you can get this cell to do it. So it's very difficult to achieve. The question at that point is, when you're using aphysiologic amounts and constellations of things that you can't find in most natural settings or wouldn't normally find, what's the meaning of that experiment anyway? And I guess the meaning of it is that commitment is not absolute. And this will depend on things like what receptors is this cell expressing? So what signals can it receive if you're able to even come up with the right kinds of signals and punch it with a whole combination of signals? And much also has to do with the kinds of systems where these experiments are typically done. And I don't know if we want to diverge into that right now, but there are things that are done with cells in culture. And there are issues about whether they retain all of the qualities of the original population. And often these things where you show that cells can kind of jump the fence come from experiments where the cells have been through a certain amount of disturbing conditioning. So I think that the idea is relatively intact, but that the absoluteness of it would not be something that I would want to jump up and down on. Then there's a differentiation switch. And at the differentiation switch, these cells come out of the cell cycle. They become post-mitotic, resting in the so-called G0 stage, and they commence to differentiate. And by differentiate, that means they now begin to make all of the protein products, express all the RNAs and make all the protein products that are typical of a mature muscle cell. And in fact, I'm making that more simple than it is. The differentiating myocyte goes through various stages of maturation beyond this, which I'm not going to undertake as part of this biology, but they do marvelous things like specialize for being fast-twitch muscle or slow-twitch muscle. But I think for the basic pathway, this is a simplification that we make, and it's one that we work with.
The suffix blast just means that it's some precursor cell? Is that
Well, blast generally, it doesn't occur in every system, but blast generally refers to both a precursor and something that has dividing potential. And I don't know if I've ever seen it absolutely cleanly defined that way, but it seems to be that that's true, whether you're in the hematopoietic system, or the bone development system, the nervous system, the neural blasts go on to become neurons, etc. What you're seeing on the right-hand panel here is my attempt to acquaint you with what actually goes into at least some commonly done experiments and into whatever microarray experiments I'm going to show you. And in this case, we're looking at a time course that is dealing with the transition from the orange committed myoblast to the purple differentiating myocyte. And we would be very happy to understand each of these transitions, the commitment switch and the determination switch, in some deeper level of detail and mechanism than we currently do. That would make us very happy. We've identified a lot of the molecules, perhaps not all the molecules, and that's one reason for going to the microarrays at this time in the progress of the field. What this is meant to point out to you is that down at the bottom, in this bottom panel, you're looking at microscopic views of cells that are taken for various of the time points. And you can see, not terribly well, you can see it better under a microscope, that in the background there are cells that are not highlighted in brown. And there are cells that are highlighted with this brown immunostain. And the immunostain is for a molecule that is specific for the differentiated state, one of these terminal downstream genes. It happens to be a heavy chain myosin.
What organism is this? Mouse?
This organism happens to be mouse. Things happen very similarly in chicken cells. Things happen very similarly in human cells.
This is a mouse culture or a mouse embryo?
I'll show you some embryos in a minute which have a very different appearance. You're looking at cells on a monolayer in a petri dish. They're growing in a medium that's enriched with all kinds of happy amino acids, appropriate salts, but also a host of growth factors. And in fact, one initiates the differentiation in these culture systems by removing those growth factors or vastly reducing their level. It drops the cells out of cycle and they spontaneously differentiate. These kinds of models are one of the reasons that people who are, I for example, confess that I am not compellingly interested in muscle biology. That's not what motivates me to look at the pathway. And that's true for a large fraction of people who use this system, though certainly not all. Some are utterly dedicated to wanting to know about skeletal muscle because they're interested, for example, in skeletal muscle disease. our reason for looking at it is partly that it was one of the earliest in which key genes in the pathway were figured out. But even apart from that, this ability to work back and forth between cells in a dish that do at least one of the steps rather well and recapitulate the steps that you see in the animal reasonably well lets us then do things like extract biochemical amounts of RNA, biochemical amounts of protein, working with a relatively homogeneous cell population. We're basically perpetually trying to reduce our problem to behave a little bit like E. coli or yeast, and yet retain some of the properties that aren't in those systems that attract us to the problem in the first place. And so that's really what drives the use of the system. We think that the differentiation transition has features of a bistable switch. It is in almost all instances in real biology a unidirectional switch. You go forward from blast to myocyte and thence ultimately to a multinucleate syncytium or myotube, and there's no going back.
Is there a way to estimate the error rate?
Ah, very interesting. Yes. Let's come to that a little bit more. So Uri asks, is there a way to estimate the error rate in going back? And first, let's just say what is known about whether you ever go back. You can make it reverse, and this was just shown in a Cell paper that was published, I think, in December, with the overexpression in just this very system, these self-same cells, of just one gene, happens to be called MSX1. That with the overexpression of that gene, you can actually get these cells to come back out of cycle. You can even, in some cases, probably recover them from the multinucleate status, which is a pretty interesting bit of cellular gymnastics in itself, and get them to come all the way back, even to the point where, before the point where they are committed myoblasts. That doesn't appear to happen often. The question, to get at Uri's question, which is something we're very interested in knowing, how often does it happen spontaneously? Thinking, you really only want to know the answer to that question, I think, in real life, in the animal. And so there are experiments that that are designed and that no one has yet completed, in which you make a permanent change in, you mark a cell that has become terminally differentiated, and you do that by using, I'm going to start speaking in tongues, the Cre-Lox recombination system to activate a reporter. I know there are three people here who know exactly what I'm talking about, and for everybody else, I would be more than happy to draw a picture. It's fun molecular biology gymnastics, and no one has done it yet that I'm aware of. It clearly needs to be done. It's also the case that in at least one system that's been looked at, the work of Jeremy Brock's, which is newt limb regeneration. These little amphibian salamanders, and if you cut off a limb, they will regenerate the limb. And in the course of that process, he looked at whether or not nuclei that had been part of differentiated muscle could ever reverse, come back and participate in the making of not only new muscle, but new other tissue. And the answer appears to be in that system. There's a little bit of argument, but the answer appears to be yes, that happens in that system. But they are much more prodigious at regeneration, those animals in general, than we are. They can regenerate things other than limbs as well. Excuse me, what? I see where the question's coming from, and it's a good question, and I don't know anything about oncology in newts. I barely know anything about it in humans and mice, but I really don't know. And so one certainly might guess that something of very high regenerative potential that can pop very primitive cells that have a lot of different potential and a lot of potential to divide might be prone to developing tumors. And indeed, MSX1 is a gene that is involved in developing some human tumors of these lineages. So there's your idea looks like it's going in the right direction, but I don't actually know if anybody has really studied newts for the occurrence of tumors, and particularly in this case, you might expect solid sarcomas of things like mesoderm. So there's a transcriptional network that goes along with this that appears on the right-hand side, and it will appear in a couple of slides with increasing degrees of number of entries. This is not atypical of what happens in other systems where people have looked at it. It isn't an absolute paradigmatic model, but it's perhaps not too bad. And so what you see colored to roughly match the cell state are the expression of a series in red there. The MyoD and MIF5 are DNA binding transcription factors. These guys interact with other proteins that deal in the business of histone acetylation and deacetylation that I'm guessing Jim Katanaga must have talked about. So they don't remodel chromatin by themselves, but they engage with other proteins that apparently do. They either do primary remodeling or they maintain remodeling, and I don't know which of those they do. They interact with yet another tier of genes that themselves encode transcription factors. And so in this case, the simple-minded model, which is well-supported but not slam-dunk proved in my mind, is that MyoD and MIF5 positively regulate each other. Though, as you'll see, there's evidence for some kind of autoregulatory feedback, at least of MyoD on itself. They, in turn, at the differentiation switch, turn on myogenin, which is a related transcription factor. That transcription factor appears to be then the key one in turning on these downstream genes that one might refer to as terminal differentiation genes, of which there are hundreds.
Can you explain this more?
Yes,
an arrow drawn out of right-left reaction, who is actually doing the job?
So what I wanted to talk to you, one of the main things I want to talk to you about is these damned arrows of ours. I'm not the only biologist that has a plethora of arrows that are highly meaningful if you're in the field because they have contextual meaning. So these arrows that you see here, which give the appearance of some kind of chemical reaction, in this case don't mean that. There's chemistry underneath it. But what you're really looking at are arrows for the nature of regulatory interactions as we understand them, and the data underneath them is almost always a combination of classical genetics and what we call molecular biology or biochemistry. So, for example, in our dreams, but I'm being a little facetious. There's an in our dreams about whether we can measure those things. Then there's a question about, even if we measured them in a test tube, how meaningful would that be relative to the living situation, which is, and there are two levels at which I think that's interesting. One is kind of trivial, which is, can you make the proteins so that they're mainly not denatured? Do you know how pure they are? Do you know how much you've really got? All those kinds of technical things. And some of these proteins do turn out to be a real pain to make lots of without having them do horrible things like, congeal into very long strings that seem to be completely unmeaningful. MyoD has a tendency to do that, for example. But apart from those technical things, when we look at what we think we know about how they interact in vivo with the DNA, they interact in what appear to be large complexes in which a single protein-DNA interaction does not describe what's going on at all that actually activates gene expression. And for that reason, I'm not sure that knowing the rate constants and the equilibrium constants for a dimerization reaction, so these molecules all have the habit of acting as dimers. This one, for example, is well known. This is a muscle type protein of what's called the BHLH type. This is a so-called E-class protein that are somewhat more broadly expressed. These two heterodimerize, and it's that heterodimer that binds to DNA in each and every one of these genes, or is thought to. This molecule up here called MEF2 is a molecule that might be called, in the case of the mammalian systems, a permissivity factor for this system. That is, it clearly makes a contribution, but it is not as powerful in a way that I'll show you in a second. As the MyoD and MIF5 and myogenin system is. So it's kind of a helper. So the right-left arrow means that MEF2 has a positive effect on the expression of myogenin. And the expression of myogenin is thought to have a positive effect on MEF2. And indeed, excuse me? And same thing upstairs. These guys appear to positively cross-regulate each other. And when we get into more elaborate diagrams, there is evidence for autoregulation, positive autoregulation of MyoD. And so when, and this kind of, to get a shade ahead of myself, these kinds of interaction, both the crosstalk and the autoregulation, I think are where some of the biological power of the system comes and are probably, arguably more interesting than what is best characterized and best studied, though I don't think it's unimportant, which is the interaction of these guys with the downstream genes. This has been a bit more accessible. This has been slightly less accessible.
So,
with the Structural Genomics Initiative, our dreams have become the dream of the collective, so at least that's a good thing. There is something known about the structure. So for MyoD, in a form that we don't even know whether it's biologically meaningful, which is to say the form of a homodimer, there is structural information, which is a co-crystal with its consensus DNA binding site, which contains a little widget, CANNTG, which is actually the generic specificity of things of this large family of transcription factors. And in that case, the structure that one has, which was published by Pavel and Weintraub about 5 years ago, I think, in Cell, if I remember correctly. It's very nice, but like so many of these things, the first thing that they did to do the crystallography was to whack off the so-called activating and regulatory domains and get it down to the domain that binds DNA, which is immediately physically adjacent to the domain that mediates protein-protein dimerization. So what we really have is a co-crystal for just the DNA binding and protein dimerization part, which gives us no insights into what the rest of the molecule might look like or how it might be interacting with other factors. There's a further story, and again, I'm jumping a few slides, but I think it's perhaps better to do it. Chemically speaking, there's also evidence that this factor, let me go through a couple things that these arrows can mean. This factor is also a DNA binding factor. It operates as a homodimer, principally, of MEF2s with MEF2s. And they have binding sites, just as these have binding sites in these genes. And it's common to, within a relatively short region, find binding sites for both types. And that's probably the kind of combinatorics that really makes these things go, or at least it's a small part of the combinatorics that make it go. At the same time, it's been shown biochemically that there's a portion of this molecule that actually can physically interact with and likes to form a higher order interaction between one of these dimers and one of these dimers. And indeed, the suggestion, though not proved, is that if you have a couple of binding sites of this motif, you may very well invite this molecule into the interaction, even if there's not a DNA binding area there, through protein-protein interaction. And so it may be that these guys are always acting together and that they can do it by being placed onto the architecture of the DNA by the sequence in front of a gene, or that they can do it by having a couple sites for either one and inviting the other partner in by protein-protein interaction. So there is chemistry in these arrows, but not the kind you were hoping for. There have been some attempts at finding affinities for MyoD binding to its site, I believe, has been tried. In each case, what's thought to be the biologically active form was not the form with which the measurement was made, because the chemistry was easier to do with homodimers rather than heterodimers, et cetera, et cetera. So let me take you through the arrows from the top. These top arrows are, some of them have names. These are upstream signals that talk themselves to other transcription factors that bind either at MyoD or at MIF5 and cause them to turn on. Then this arrow is to indicate what we know in this case to be a direct physical interaction of one or the other of these with the myogenin gene. Myogenin dimerizes with E and engages in direct physical interaction with these.
You said physical interaction with the myogenin gene?
Yes. Meaning that, yes.
So the origins are both of them, and if you don't, part of
They are MyoD, MIF5, myogenin, and a fourth family member not listed here for reasons of it being an unnecessary complication, are closely related to each other. They are of the family of so-called BHLH DNA binding proteins, and they all descended from one gene. So if you go back and look at Drosophila or look at the worm, they have one MyoD-like gene. We have four. Most of the vertebrates have four. And this physical interaction, which I have just asserted, is implied in many ways. The actual physical measurement that shows that molecule binding in vivo to that gene has, to my knowledge, not yet been done, although by the mechanism of experiments of the sort called chromatin immunoprecipitation, or the assay of such that kind of an experiment on a chip, wide scale, you should be able to explicitly prove this. So what there is, there are consensus sites there. If you blow out the consensus sites, they do not work. The consensus sites are sites that MyoD likes to bind to. If you do an in vivo footprint, which I'll show you in a moment, you can see occupancy at that site of something. It does not prove that it is MyoD or MIF5, but it is most likely to be so. If you genetically blow out MyoD and MIF5 together, then this never comes on. If you genetically blow out myogenin, this muscle differentiation in the main does not happen. And so what I have been telling you that I know is confusing is exactly what I intended to illustrate a certain amount of confusion about. Typically, arrows in a diagram like this will have meaning in terms of genetics because the genes have been knocked out, if it's a well-studied system. They'll often have meanings if these are transcription factor cascades in terms of DNA binding in vitro. They will typically have the definition of consensus sites and an analysis of the putative target gene to see if it has not only a consensus site, but if you remove that consensus site, do you find now that the putative interaction and the biology underlying that interaction, the driving of that gene, is affected, either eliminated or downregulated, or in the case of a negative regulator, upregulated. So that's the kind of evidence that typically sits underneath these things. What there tends not to be, in certainly in most of the metazoa, and even in studies in yeast, there tends not to be that kind of biophysical grip that von Hippel was talking about, for example, that has come out of some of the classical studies of a few of the bacterial genes and bacterial phage genes, where people really spent a long time and worked very hard to push the numbers, and where the number of different, I think it's fair to say, that the number of different regulatory proteins interacting nearby to these genes to affect their regulations is much, much simpler. Instead of having a glob of what may be 20 or 30 proteins, there might be the binding of one repressor or two repressors or three repressors. And so I'm not sure this is correct, but I think many of us have the feeling that those kinds of biophysical measurements probably can be done much better in systems where to do it right, you don't have to assemble 20 different things. 20 may be an exaggeration, but when you've got five or six different things binding to the DNA, and then several of them interact with other proteins, I don't think 20 is way off the mark. Yeah? Well, let me skip this for a second and Yes, and it gets worse after this. So this is a beginning sampling of the inhibitors. And this is probably key, and people working in the field were initially deliriously happy because of sort of the intellectual appeal of first finding that there were negative regulators and finding the first ones that were found were these things called IDs or IDs. And again, there are four of them in the mammalian systems. And they have the property of interacting stoichiometrically with these MIF5, MyoD, myogenin, and most particularly and most efficaciously with the partners, the enabling partner of the E protein type. And so ID is actually a member of the same kind of family structurally. It simply lacks the DNA binding domain and other regulatory things, and it's mainly the protein-protein dimerization domain walking around without very much other information. And so when it heterodimerizes, you now can't bind to the DNA because you need two of these DNA binding things joined in order to lock onto the DNA. So biochemically, it makes a very nice picture, which is that if you add enough of this stoichiometrically, you can stop these guys from going anywhere. If you ask how this is expressed in cells, you can see that this is expressed high up in cells that are not going to begin to differentiate and may not even have yet expressed these. But even while these are being expressed, this will be on. And the thought, which was very, very attractive at the time and is probably, is very elegant, and it may also be wrong, was that ID was actually the molecular explanation for how it is that you could have commitment. So commitment can be the expression of these muscle-specific. I hasten to tell you that each of these, MIF5, MyoD, myogenin, and the relative called MRF4, are only expressed in skeletal muscle progenitors and cells that are skeletal muscle. Nowhere else. As in all biology, there's actually a funky place in the brain where there's some MIF5, but that also is a coffee discussion. One never knows when its evolution run amok just playing with itself. So these are skeletal muscle specific. This is more generic and probably regulates the family in many places, but it would be very nice if you turn these on and yet they weren't able to go interact with their DNA targets as long as ID was present. And that would kind of describe in molecular terms the cellular phenomenon of being committed. So as soon as you release ID, away you go, and the only place you're going to go is toward the muscle pathway because you've already engaged in this molecular decision to express members of this family. So this machine is just sitting there ready to pounce. Now, for reasons that I think I don't want to get to, or I'll never get past about, you know, slide 10. Well, I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but that we can say more about later. Maybe that's just the place. Yeah, I'm just going to halt there for a second and go to the other negative regulator, which is this MSX1. And it acts on these guys, at least, and has been known for a while. And I have it up here just to illustrate negative regulators. And the big idea that started to emerge was that there are lots of negative regulators. I don't have them all listed. There are, in fact, I'm not even sure right now that I could list all the negative regulators of the system that have the power, when expressed highly at least, to stop this system from going forward. And so one way of looking at this, which is not particularly appealing to me, because it doesn't have enough mechanism behind it, but for the moment, the state of the art is there's a strong forward force once you're expressing these myogenic regulators, and given that they positively cross-regulate, to go in the direction of becoming muscle and of differentiating, and you've essentially got to do something in non-mechanistic terms, but in biological terms, to hold that system back from spontaneously differentiating before it is supposed to. And there's an even, to me, more interesting question, which is, how do you prevent occasional sort of accidental expression of a MIF5 or a MyoD from just popping a muscle cell just in J random place? Because once you get this thing in motion, I'm going to go back and show you something else. There are broadly, so the question is, are these graduated responses or are these on-off responses? And the answer is, as it often is, both. Some genes specialize in graduated response, and you can see it in, you can see what looks like a good explanation for how they do that in the way that their regulatory sequences are arrayed. One that we studied years ago is one that's involved in called metallothionine, and it's involved in heavy metal regulation. And so as you start adding something like zinc or cadmium, and you need to basically scavenge it and keep it from hurting the cell, this metallothionein protein is made, which binds these things. The metallothionein gene itself is regulated by having multiple binding sites for the same factor, which is itself metal sensitive. And that gene runs at a low basal level all the time in all cells that we ever looked at. And then what you get is gradually increased occupancy from the highest affinity sites to the lower affinity sites with these metal-inducible factors. And what you get in response out as a readout is varied levels of transcription. And so that's a system, and we did in vivo footprinting, we can show that the occupancy of those sites changes as you titrate things up, and that it changes in a knowable order. It isn't an all or nothing phenomenon. For many of these developmentally regulated genes, like the terminal muscle genes, where we've done the same kind of experiment, we get a different kind of impression, and that's an impression that is relatively all or nothing. Even there, there's tuning of the amounts of RNA overall over the long haul, and the relative contribution in all of this, in the regulatory circuitry, we tend to focus on those things that lead to regulated synthesis. Regulated decay for generating a dynamic steady state or for changing control is, in some cases, the dominant force. In many cases, it's got to be a contributor, or else as soon as you start synthesizing, you would just endlessly accumulate, and that's clearly not how things work. So the issue of regulated decay is an issue, and I would say that for reasons of relative ease of study, for reasons that are sort of prejudices about what's interesting and what might have the highest information content, there has tended to be in the regulatory biology of gene regulation a vast overemphasis on the study of what initiates synthesis, and a relative underemphasis on rates of elongation, although that's in there and getting more attention, and a disturbing disemphasis on regulated degradation. And so, I mean, that's just when you go out there, and if you start to go, if we seduce some of you guys into actually engaging in modeling, one of the things that I would hope to accomplish by having spent a few hours is to at least sensitize you to this unevenness effect in what it is that we focus on and what it is that's in the phenomenology that, for either a good reason of not being able to measure it very well, or for a real stupid reason like community prejudice about how things work, biases what we know about and what the inputs are compared to what might actually be going on. I wanted to come back to this slide to point something out, and that is that one of the things that attracted some attention when this pathway first was illuminated by the discovery of the one called MyoD, which happened to be the first one that was found, is that in addition to the genetics of loss of function, which came later, so I told you what happens when you knock these genes out, the thing that really surprised people was that you could do an experiment in which you had a cell that was not a muscle precursor. It could be a liver cell or a connective tissue thing called a fibroblast, or even a melanocyte, a differentiated cell that makes pigment in the skin. And you could take any of those cells and by, you know, sort of standard methods, add an expressible MyoD gene so that it's now expressing. And what you would get is something that is, roughly speaking, a conversion to a myoblast-like state. And then by giving it the typical kinds of cues and drawing it out of cell cycle, you could get this thing to express, in molecular terms anyway, all these downstream muscle genes. And so from that, there came a suggestion by the most enthusiastic interpreters that this comprised a master regulator. And the idea of master regulator had been floating around before as a notion, the idea being that you can't have infinite regress without having these regulatory cascades ultimately come to something approximating an apex, so that you've got some regulator that's governing something about a whole pathway, instead of going up and having many, many regulators at every single tier. And so this ability, which is the so-called gain-of-function assay as opposed to the loss-of-function genetic assay, is one that not so many regulators actually score positive in. So broadly, I think it would be fair to say that in the metazoan systems, there are many more transcription factors or genes for transcription factors that can be disrupted and thereby cause a reduction or elimination of expression of downstream genes. Then there are genes which, when added to the cell, will cause a wholesale transition in genes that are expressed.
You also have like expression of MyD.
Yep. It's been done both ways. The experiments, it depends on the system. There are certain systems that are particularly amenable to the injection of RNA, a Xenopus oocyte, for example. People tried to do this early on by injecting RNA into animal cells, which is very hard and not really worth the trouble. There are pretty sophisticated systems, where sophisticated means successful and well worked out. Sophisticated does not mean what one would like it to mean. And so an interesting thing to consider maybe before the break, and then we can break. An interesting thing that I'd like to focus your attention on is the fact that add here is typically adding it in quantities that probably mean that the recipient cell was seeing a level of expression of MyoD far above what any normal cell becoming muscle ever sees. And so if you then refer to the system's positive feedbacks and crosstalk and think about what happens if you punch in a level of one of these things that's maybe 5 or 10 times higher on average than what any normal cell ever sees, the question is whether this dominance has actually reflects what's going on in normal development, or whether the dominance in the assay reflects coming up over a threshold level and activating the entire network. And so the place that I was going with this little slide to take you to is the notion that one interpretation of this, or reinterpretation of it, from the original grand enthusiasm of we found a regulator and it activates the whole pathway by itself, is that as we learned about more and more components of the pathway, it's the network itself that's dominant. It's probably the properties of the network, which are what we would like to be able to better model in some more quantitative and dynamic way, both assay and model, that give you the ability to switch cell type. But that's where it's actually coming from. Yeah?
In this experiment, my view is that do these cells become muscle cells?
That's an extremely good question. It was an important question at the time. And that is, in the course of becoming a muscle cell, is that dominance also something that suppresses the other extant phenotype, or do you get some very peculiar cell that has the properties of a differentiated hepatocyte and a differentiated muscle cell? And the answer in this case seemed to be that the muscle pathway, if you kept the cells for a while, would dominate, but that you would go through a transient period in which there was co-expression of what you would call terminal products for both. The question is, what's the meaning of that co-expression? And so if the meaning of the co-expression is only that the half-life of some pigment melanocyte-specific genes or hepatocyte-specific genes at the protein level and the RNA level is a long time after you shut off the actual new synthesis, then the conversion is really complete and you're just looking at sort of the sequelae and the decay of another phenotype. The other possibility is that they're actually being actively synthesized for some considerable period. And I think that's something that arguably hasn't been looked at rigorously enough, but it appeared that you didn't maintain co-expression for a long time. There are always problems in these experiments that have to do with the fact that most of these cell cultures don't go on living forever. And so you begin to get into problems not only of what's going on with the cells, but just of gross cell health and the activation either of death because of lack of trophic factor or even active apoptosis. And there's a whole interesting set of ideas about whether, especially in the animal, in various kinds of mutants, if a cell really jumps the rails and assumes some kind of peculiar mixed phenotype, is there something like a developmental checkpoint in which the cell recognizes that it is, in some way, it's monitoring what it's doing, it realizes it's doing two antithetical things, and then does what lots of disease cells do, which is to activate apoptotic pathways and commit suicide. And that, to me, is an interesting and, I think, for the moment, unanswered question. There's clearly a lot of programmed cell death, but whether that's a way of cleaning up your mistakes, I don't know.
Is there an
Yeah. Oh, God, I knew a question like that would come eventually. oh, take it before the coffee. I do not...
Resource
constraints. In very... So I, resource constraints, which we biologists can cope with a little bit better than the energy calculations most of the time, probably do happen in a few rare cases. And so, for example... there are instances, I think, where you're building up gigantic specialized cells like eggs, oocytes, where you may actually be at the outer limits of what the transcriptional capacity of the cell can do at any given moment. You've simply got to subdivide that among the genes that are on. In most cases, I think we suspect that that's not limiting, but the question is really whether we have a good reason to think what we think. In terms of knowing the numbers of polymerase molecules, rates of polymerization, and such like, which would presumably be where the limitation comes from. In terms of energy constraints, it certainly isn't something that's routinely in our repertoire to measure. It is something that we do actually occasionally try to think about, but often hit the frustration barrier fairly quickly. I think for not knowing enough, and I have heard people that I think are much more sophisticated in what they have tried to do with it than I am say that they haven't ever found a case in which energy calculations seem to be limiting. And so if you look at how much ATP is available in the cell and you look at how much you suppose is being used in a process like transcription, it's pretty minor stuff. And certainly what some of these cells do with energy when they're doing things like muscle contraction when they mature is probably way over the top in terms of the demands on the cell. And so it's probably other aspects of metabolism that dominate and not these regulatory aspects. But everything I have just told you is, you know, it's perilously close to bullshit in answer to the energy question. And you just to be very clear about where to put it in the pantheon of... it's a perfect match. Okay. Coffee? So I want to get to both some real data and to do, as we were talking in the coffee room, there are some problems that I think people in this group could perchance make great progress on. And we want to just, one of my missions is to call attention to those problems. So this is a kind of cartoon that I think you have seen probably before in the course of this, and I just want to use it to make a few points. It's your generic eukaryotic gene. And the generic eukaryotic gene has features which are subtle and not so subtle variations on what is known about the structure of bacterial genes. These regulatory elements relative to the protein-coding sequence often sit at considerable distance. The distances can be hundreds of bases, but the distance for a site that has regulatory impact on an adjacent gene can also be hundreds of kilobases away. That's not typical, but it's not so unusual. And the thought is that it operates by assembling a protein complex, which then interacts with proteins that assemble the proximal promoter, and the DNA is along for the ride bending around in order to make that possible. These things, in the jargon of different organisms, people use different words in the mammalian world. The word enhancer, as in to enhance transcription, is often used for the cis-regulatory sequences that sit at some distance. They can be right next door to the proximal promoter. They can also be, as I said, far away. Enhancers are something that the assays that uncover these things are particularly sensitive to. So this issue of what it is that we know the most about, things that have positive effect are simply easier to see in the assays and they're easier to believe. And for that reason, there's probably a bigger catalog of these than there are of so-called negative regulators or silencers. It is not the case that repression is a non-mechanism in the higher eukaryotic cells. It is a mechanism. There are individual factors that act negatively, and there are whole modules that have negative readout. There's a famous group for neural-specific genes that are silenced in virtually every other cell in the body,
and are on because the silencing is not functioning in the neural system. There's a key factor there. It's a zinc finger factor called NRSF. Should someone wish to look it up. And so although things are often portrayed in this positive acting way, it's partly because the assays lead us to pick these out most easily. Both things happen. There's the idea that these modules act to give essentially an integrated action that reflects the inputs of multiple sequence-specific DNA binding proteins and of proteins that bind to those proteins, interacting not directly with the DNA but indirectly, including some of these histone-modifying enzymes, among others. And these things tend to like to make protein contacts with many different kinds of factors. These things are meant to be identified as binding specifically to the DNA. The consensus binding sites and behavior for these things, which I'll show in slightly more detail for a specific case, tend to be short sequences. These are sequences that are not at all unique in the genome. A consensus site can be, as I said, CANNTG, or slightly more than that, 6 bases, 8 bases with degeneracy. There's still a lot of specificity there. And so you can show the specificity biochemically. The given protein will bind its site, and if you mutate key residues in that site or present it with some other scramble of that sequence, it will have several logs of specificity for its site versus the others. But in another sense, the sites are not so specific because they occur all over the genome. They're specific when they're in context. And so that's what drives the idea that you're not only getting an integrated readout, but that you probably require the collaborative interaction here of these factors, partly because they touch each other as protein-protein interactions, as I described explicitly for the MEF2 MRF class of interactions. One of the nice things to give you explicit kinds of regulatory pathways and an enormous amount of potential complexity is that it is fairly usual for different factors binding at the same enhancer or silencer to be responding to different input signals from the cell. So some will respond to a MAP kinase cascade, another will respond to a calcineurin sensitive cascade, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah?
Maybe a question. Well, I understand that the short sequence, the upstream region, there may be a large window there between them and the start of the exome. How does the DNA, how does the RNA know that these proteins are bound there?
Good question. No, that's a perfectly good question. At the proximal promoter, there are also assembled a largish group of proteins with which RNA polymerase then interacts and ultimately starts initiation. And the thinking that has been around for a long time is that this interaction is not very efficient and also not very stable if these proteins aren't in proximity, but the DNA is flexible enough and diffusion fast enough that this is bending around, and so once something like this assembles, it then attracts and stabilizes the assembly of an initiation complex there, and then polymerase is attracted to the aggregate of all of that. I think there are an enormous number of surprises, and I would hasten to say that that of the experts, for example, you've seen Katanaga, and I think you've got one more coming up, who are really good in the biochemistry of transcription. It could be that there are things in that area that may have come up in part in consequence of the chromatin modification, but also just the biochemistry of this complex, which is something that I don't consider myself expert in. And your answer may, your question may have a more sophisticated answer than the one that I gave you as of the last year or two.
When you say attracts, presumably the interaction between these complexes is fairly short range. So what's been happening is that the two tethered complexes are fusing around
and kiss, apparently kissing each other
and staying.
And a mark, something that I'm interested in and have, I'm deluded, I may have thought of a way to experimentally do it. I would love to know what the real stability of a complex like this is in vivo. And one of the reasons that I am not much attracted to investing a lot of time and energy in measuring the affinity of this for its site and of this for its site is that this stripped down cartoon of what's going on is what I think I want to measure. I would love to measure the in vivo stability of this complex. And that's something that, to my knowledge, has not been done. What we did invest ourselves in some time ago was working out how to at least show which sites have occupancy in vivo, and then we contrasted and compared that with biochemical measurements for factors that are in a slurry from the nucleus and that will react with consensus sites, which is the standard way to infer that a particular site is occupied in vivo. And I'm only going to tell you sort of what the global take-home lessons are.
Are there dangers to taking a holistic approach in these complexes, since they always seem to act in single aggregate? Why not just call it one thing? Or is it true that the subunits mix and match to make other flavors of the holistic?
Yeah. So I'm just going to tell you what my gut feeling is. My gut feeling is that for a given enhancer in a cell in a particular state, it's receiving a set of signals and sort of corresponds to that cartoon that I just showed you, that in that case, one might take a rather try to measure the holistic output of the complex and treat it as a holistic element, as it were, although that word I find very California disturbing. But on the other hand, it is very clear that within one of these given enhancer elements, one of the ones that we beat to death in the muscle business the most, that it is not occupied identically, probably, in all muscle types. And so the output can be modulated, and one might wonder, for example, about whether the subtle addition of something out here can make this slightly more longer lived and slightly more effective, or might have some interesting little domain that draws in another protein that ups the level of efficiency, which goes to the question that was asked a while ago. Is it on or off, or is it graded? To which I irritatingly said both. And I think one of the ways that it can be graded is that you can have enough to run it, and then you can probably in another state make a tuning addition. And that makes enormous sense, I think, in terms of what you want the outputs to be, and therefore back asswards what I suppose evolution might have done with just this sort of basic setup to work from. So we actually, this is just to give the impression, I think correctly, that although most of what we know about protein DNA binding has been done by taking crude nuclear extracts and mixing it up with binding sites and asking what sticks, that you can then contrast what you get in that experiment with what you get when you do a somewhat more difficult to do experiment and compare what goes on in the test tube. This is naked DNA that's been cleaved with an agent, DML set, that cleaves at a subset of the residues. And you contrast what goes on when the agent is presented to naked DNA with the agent presented to cells. This happens to be a membrane permeant agent that goes in and modifies the DNA very rapidly on a time scale of half a minute or so. And what you see here in the areas that are either now unoccupied, as inferred by the fact that the agent injected the DNA, or hypersensitized, as indicated by a darker band, is the occupancy of something at a site that we know, which happens to be a binding site for the transcription factor. I dug this slide out partly because it goes back to Katanaga's work. He was the discoverer of SP1. It was one of the first transcription factors, DNA sequence-specific transcription factors, that was ever isolated from a higher eukaryote at any rate. And you find the known consensus site, and indeed it is that consensus site that's occupied in these cells. And so we have done that and tap danced all over a number of different genes. And one of the ones that is that we have looked at the most because it's part of this muscle pathway is in one of these things that comes on upon differentiation. And we have been able to see occupancy for this and this, at this consensus site, at this consensus site, at this site, and at this site. And it is still, per the question earlier, an inference based on what we know about consensus sites for these things, what we know about things that are being expressed, what we know about dimerization propensity, that the occupancy, which is definitive occupancy, actually corresponds to these molecules. And there is one class of experiment that will definitively show that, and what we've been working on and others have been working on, and I think are slightly more advanced than we are, is that getting this kind of an assay up to the point where it can be done on a chip so that instead of doing it at great labor on a gene-by-gene basis, you'll be able to put on the chip many candidate cis elements like this and define where you've got an antibody or have otherwise tagged the molecule, whether you do indeed have the positive binding, and be able to sort out what kind of a mix there is from, I told you there were four of these MRFs. They all tend to be expressed in the cell when it's actually actively differentiating. The genetics suspects that this one is important, but we don't know what mile whatever is here, and I think it would be nice to know that.
How many bases are
you doing here? Yeah, so this is over about a 200 base pair region, 200, I think this one is bounded functionally about 206.
Well, the
binding sites for each one of these. The consensus binding site and the bases that are detected when you use a small alkylating agent like DMS are on the order of 6 to 10 bases. If you use a different kind of agent to come in and ask about, you know, sort of where does the protein kind of plop down, not literally contact the DNA, but if you ask another big protein to come in like DNAs, then you can show what these areas actually look like are large areas of clearing in total. In DNAs, there'll be very little cleaving in the entire area, and it'll be rather more difficult to get resolution on specific sites.
And usually how many factors, how many molecules have you
known? How many molecules? Oh, of these transcription factors. That's an irritating and good question. It varies, I think, quite significantly depending upon the factor. We're talking about things that at the RNA level are supported by as few as thought to be measured at about 10 molecules per cell of messenger RNA, upwards to several hundred, 1,000 tops. These are generally called low prevalence or low abundance proteins, low prevalence and low abundance RNAs.
Messenger
20 messenger RNAs that then support. And the reason that I'm waffling is that an actual measurement of the number of protein molecules that are generated off of those RNA templates has not been made as accurately as have been the measurements of the RNA themselves. And so depending upon what the turnover time is, very often transcription factors that have sort of a lot of regulatory leverage and are found only under a particular circumstance, only to turn on particular genes, those things, not universally, but often tend to turn over fast. And if you think about that, that's actually nice, because what it lets you do is give you a sharp curve in the rise, and it also allows you, if you're shutting it off, to get rid of them because you want them to not be there. And so in general, their steady state rate of turnover is high, and there's good evidence for some of them, not particularly for these, but for some of them, that, and actually it's coming along for these, that aggressively regulated protein turnover is also a big part of their biology. And so when we talk about something present or absent and measure it by the gene chip gain, as we now do because it's accessible, there is the real problem that often regulation at the protein level is faster and critical for explaining what the system is doing. So if I had my druthers, I would throw away all of my gene chips tomorrow if somebody could give me that antibody chip that we were discussing, for sure. The other thing that I would say that's general, it reflects itself in this particular promoter with respect to a couple of these sites, and it reflects itself in most other complexes like it, and that is that there seems to be a collaboration often between one or two kinds of factors here, mainly these VHLH proteins of the MRF class that are very specific to turning these genes on and off, and another set of factors that tend to be around in lots of cells. They're kind of around all the time, and they're presumably, one might guess, there to be drawn upon with these things acting in some fashion as nucleating sites that bring things to the DNA, and at that point, by some form of what we suspect is cooperative binding, but nobody's done enough of the chemistry to prove it. What we can say is that occupancy is highly coordinated. What else we can say is that often when you do pairwise tests to see if the proteins will stick to each other with significant affinity, they do. We therefore infer cooperativity of the binding to stabilize the complex. And it isn't that all of them are very specific. Yeah.
When you see two binding sites, is that sort of the strongest signal to remove one protein, or is it really the quite two?
So in other words, a pair like this, for example. I think it's fair to say there's not a definitive answer to that. The suspicion, strongly, is that multiples of these sites, if you strip out everything else, can be made to deliver up a regulatory response that a single site will not do. And the way that we know that is that that's a classic early 90s graduate student experiment. You find the factor, the binding site for some factor that you think is of interest, and then you multimerize that site, strip out everything else, you make a multimer with 4 or 6 or 8 of them, you throw it in front of a promoter that's otherwise very stupid and a reporter gene, and you ask, does it now confer the nature of regulation that you think is attributable to this thing, and you find out that it is. If you put one site there, it's insufficient. And one would presume that there's a good reason why both evolution and graduate students do that, which is that a lonely site out there is something that's just out in the chromosome anyway. And so if they had enough affinity and enough stability, you'd be getting, you know, misfires of all kinds of genes because these sites are just littered around because they are so relatively short.
One last small question. How do these transcription factors know to find their way back into the nucleus after they're translated down the cytoplasm?
Well, they can use different pathways, and that is often a regulated step. So there are some families where the key regulated step is whether you're being held hostage out in the cytoplasm and ineffectual or being permitted to go into the nucleus. There are so-called nuclear localization tags, which exist on many things that go to the nucleus, which include but are not restricted to transcription factors.
I think they're
sort of a few digits of a zip code. There's a whole interesting subform of cell biology that's emerging, which is subnuclear localization. And the question of what the domains really are, which is another reason why I think it's interesting to question what kinds of measurements you really want to make about protein-DNA interactions that will matter. And one of the questions is, what concentration are you measuring? Are you measuring, so crudely put, is it the concentration in the whole cell, which is more easy to measure, or are you measuring the concentration in the cytoplasm, or the concentration in the nucleus, or is the concentration that really matters in some specialized subcompartment of the nucleus? And the best reason, there are two good reasons for thinking that subcompartmentalization in the nucleus is probably a bigger deal than we currently tend to incorporate into our everyday thinking. One has been around forever, and that is the existence of the nucleolus, which is a non-membrane bounded subnuclear compartment where the ribosomal genes are, where they coalesce to be transcribed, and where the ribosome is assembled. There are also these apparently little splicing factories dotted around at many more sites than just one or two as the nucleolus, which seem to be the sites of very active RNA splicing activity. And so splicing is often, can be co-transcriptional. One suspects a much richer organization of active transcriptional complexes, and there's the whole story of matrix attachment sites, et cetera, et cetera. So the issue of where are they going and how informatic is that zip code? Does it just get you inside the nuclear envelope where you commence to float around and find where you're going? Or is it a sophisticated many-digit zip code that takes you into the nucleus and then takes you elsewhere? I do not know the answer to that, and I do not think it is well known yet. This is doing that experiment on this gene that I just showed you that highlights these sites, and I'm just going to skip past this. This is just to show in specific what I was saying about these binding sites not being very big and very informative. It was also, so for these MyoD class things, they like something that is globally CANNPG, which are generic E boxes, and there are hundreds of these BHLH proteins, and they all like something of that form. Some of them are specific for nerve cells, some of them are specific in adrenal cells, some of them are specific in the development of blood cells. And they're all seeking out CANNTG, which ain't much. The muscle ones actually have a little more particularity to them, but not a lot, which is this consensus here, purine, purine, CA, CG, PG. And this, the nature of this consensus was derived by looking at multiple genes, and a really nice paper by Chip Lawrence and colleagues that was out in Nature Genetics in November or December of 2000, which for people who are interested in thinking about sequence searching using both phylogenetic footprinting, which we are using and which I hope to get to, and I think you've already seen, however, one talk on that, so I'm going to not worry about getting to it in too much detail, together with looking for consensus sites. And I am optimistic with that strategy of trying to leverage two kinds of relatively weak DNA. If you just look for places where you've got individual sites, it's hopeless. If you know enough about a particular kind of expression to identify three or four factors, and you have even weak consensus sites, then if you go and search, particularly if you search not the whole genome, and you say within a window of 200 to 400 bases, give me anything, different people do it in different ways. The approach that we have used is show me anything that's a 300 base block that has these in, giving them either unit value or varying to some extent the value that you give to the presence of any one of these. Show me something that has six. Show me anything that has eight, et cetera, et cetera. And you can walk your way through, and you can walk your way through and ask how often that will occur randomly. You can walk your way through and ask how often that should probably have meaning. If the only genes and areas you're searching are the areas that surround genes that have come up with this pattern of expression on a chip, then you have further limited your search area. And so I think it's by that kind of sequential filtering that we're actually finally having some luck in being able to find these computationally. The way that these elements, these 200 to 400 base pair elements that are cis-regulatory, are found normally, just to backfill a little piece of the talk, is very laborious. It has historically been one gene, one set of cis elements, one graduate student, one thesis. That's how the 80s and part of the 90s were conducted. And it was even worse to do it than it is to hear about it. So people really do not want to go dissect genes in that way again. And so an important thing to be able to do is to figure out how to scan the genome broadly to find all cis regulatory elements and then to class them out and figure out what pathways they're a part of. And then, either working bottom up or top down, to figure out what the binding consensus sites are in them that actually define them and ultimately relate them to the factors. And so one of the things to be clear about what a big contribution would be, whether by leveraging several kinds of data or by some insight into the information content and structure of cis elements that we have not yet been able to discern, but which may be in there, being able to map them across the genome is the current challenge, rather than doing them as one-off gene affairs. This is just to make points that have already been made, that the elements can be far away, and that it is common, particularly for things that are of great regulatory interest, for a gene to have not one of these elements located far or near, but for it to have several. And so what's highlighted here is the position of 1, 2, 3, 4 different such elements that all drive this gene. There's an interesting little bit of phenomenology. One generally thinks about these things as operating on the nearest adjacent gene, but here we have something that operates over the top of at least one gene, probably more, that are sitting in the middle. So there is, this is always when the head shaking starts. Now, these different elements are not all at work on this gene in the same cell at the same time. And so this is where the biology is really happening. We use the cells in a dish when we can to do the biochemistry. But ultimately, what we have to explain is what's going on. And this is a little mouse embryo. Here's his head up here. And this is coming down. The neural tube is in the center along the back. And this is curling around to the tail. And what you see in dark outline here is the expression of this gene. And that gene in different domains at different times is governed by different of these elements. And in those different domains, it's responding to different signals that cause this gene to turn on. Because when you develop a cell that's in the milieu that's eventually going to make the head muscle is not being subjected to the same signals as the cell that's going to make muscle that goes out into your limb, which you can barely see here, or muscle that's going to be your deep back muscle, which is what's most nicely highlighted along here. They're receiving different signals, so they got to be plugged into different places, and that generally records as different cis elements.
You deleting histones from the cartoon, or there aren't
histones? Oh, we're very big on deleting histones from the cartoon. Partly, they take up much space and require much drawing time. Secondly, and that alone is a reason to not do it, but there is the issue of exactly what the histone clearing and non-clearing of such a gene would be. And since this is meant to describe the total capability of the gene in many different cells, presumably, the chromatin configuration in a cell that's using this upstream enhancer that drives expression in limbs is going to be different if you're looking in a cell that's using this thing that drives expression in your future rib muscles. So I also can take the excuse that I couldn't possibly draw it without being in the fourth dimension as well. It would have to be time-resolved histone occupancy. All right, so I'm going to show you a little bit of our particular take on the phylogenetic footprinting way of looking for cis regulatory elements and make just a couple of brief points from it. There are lots of ways of coming at this. I think you've already seen some. The idea is take two or three or more genomes, find the same protein coding sequence, and now search in the domain surrounding that protein coding sequence for areas that are more conserved than just randomly varying DNA. And one posits that the regulatory elements, that is to say the pink boxes of the diagram, will be among those things that are somewhat more conserved. And so if we look at a case that we know, like that gene that we were just hammering on, one of the graduate students in my group and one in Eric Davidson's group, initially at Eric's behest when he first got his first back sequences back, constructed a nice little interactive viewer. And so this isn't for scanning the whole genome. But from a biologist's point of view, if we get an array of genes, we would like to have somebody scan and map every cis element in the genome for us. That's what we want to get to. But for now, when we tend to have gene by gene by gene, 100 kilobase, 150 kilobase areas, it's very nice to be able to compare them with each other and to be able to not only see sequences that are conserved, but see what their relatedness is as you shift the criteria and stringency for relatedness. So we're looking at things that up top is a classic histogram, which is the way this is usually expressed, and little peaks in the histogram, which probably don't show well at this magnification, represent things that are more highly conserved, and this tells you the percentage above a particular criterion. But using a sliding criterion and using this interesting little way of visualizing it, where you simply draw a line that connects for a sliding window, what we've done is to walk these sequences across each other in a sliding 50 base pair window, mandating a particular percentage of similarity and then sliding that percentage of similarity. And what you see is going from the ridiculous, this is 50 kb by 50 kb, to the informative, highlighting some things that are probably very, that we know are very male, and some things that may or may not be a functional interest, down to a very tight filtration at 90% sequence. It turns out that what you're looking at here in these lines are each of the exons of this MCK gene. And the key regulatory enhancer at 90 is almost not visible. This is it. And as you go back up here, you can see it very clearly. You can also see the next gene up the line and the sequence here that we don't yet know the certain significance of, but are looking into. This turns out to be, for us, on the scale that is very current, this year, this time, an extremely useful tool. The next question is, what leverage do you get from a third genome? Most of these comparisons are done as two genomes. Mouse and human, thank God, are at a relatively informative distance for this purpose, which is about 100 million years. The years are not important, but the amount of genetic change is. And that seems to have been good enough to sift out a lot of changes in not functionally interesting areas. Nevertheless, it is not clear that two genomes alone is good enough. And what you're looking at here is a little adjustment in the algorithm to be able to simultaneously filter for everything that is retained in three genomes which is what's shown here, versus looking at these as binary comparisons. And the third genome here is rabbit. And it just happened to be one for which sequence was available, and you're now looking at a smaller scale of sequence, which is a couple of kilobases. And this turns out to be an proximal promoter region with adjacent regulatory sequences, and this is the upstream regulatory enhancer. And clearly, when you turn the third genome on, well, so it could be literally genetic rearrangements, which is insertion and deletion. And how much of those gymnastics on which scale occur in the genome is sort of one of the mysteries that we don't know the answer to. But there are also simply sequences that tend to occur as what I would call, in informational terms, artifacts. There are things, for example, that polymerases are prone to do, little stretches of A's, little stretches of G's. And you'll see those and pick them up as things that often occur once and occur somewhere else. In this case, this one, somebody's looking at it now to see if it actually has some functional significance. So by the time you get to the third genome, it's at least interesting. And the moving around does imply indels of various sizes, insertions and deletions. So you've been allowed to get rid of information and compress it or expand it fairly freely. There's a question of why this should even work. If you think about it, we already know that these little binding sites are permitted to waffle around in how far away they are from each other. They can kind of freely move by some numbers of bases and still be pretty effective at doing what they're doing. There are cases where you can't take it around a half turn of DNA, but in many other cases you can even oppose them on opposite faces of DNA and it doesn't matter. So why should you actually have retention of enough sequence similarity for this to work? Because you might expect that these little indels and things, you know, loss of a base, and there is nothing to compel retention of frame in the same sense as reading frame in a protein coding sequence. And the answer is that, in fact, you do lose some of the frame. It's just that enough is retained at appropriate differences to see it. And so the system has been further improved by just using this to highlight areas which are genuine similarity. And if you look at the sequence closely, what you find is that there's been a one-base shift, and there's a whole sequence here that's a perfect match, one-base offset. So what you do is, once you get down into these sequences, you cut loose a classic gap blast or something like that that allows little small gapping, and then you can find the other sites. At this point in time, for using the phylogenetic footprinting, key issues are what genomes are optimally spaced, how much do different genes have the same kind of rate of change. They're very different in some cases. At least there's initial evidence to that effect. And how do you do the scale up to the whole genome level? What genome X is going to be is not so clear for the vertebrates, and there are experiments ongoing trying to figure out what the best third genome would actually be. One that's likely to come on the horizon, but that might be a little far away for some purposes, is Fugu. Does everybody know about the peculiarity of the pufferfish genome? What's cool? Okay. The 30-second thing, what's cool about the pufferfish genome is that it makes a more or less good card-carrying vertebrate with brain parts that correspond to ours, with most of the body parts that correspond to our own, and yet the genome is eightfold smaller. And that eightfold compression is not an elimination of most of the proteins. The gene number is very similar, and so what you've eliminated is just a lot of this DNA out there that seems able to change. How this compression was established and effected is not so clear, but it is Sidney Brenner and God's gift to molecular biology. The problem, such as it is that it is several hundred million years out, and it may be a bit far away for picking up these elements as efficiently, but the noise should be down. So, and that is being sequenced currently. Rashly promised at the beginning of this that I was going to go through the use of microarray data to some extent to try to get new members of a complex and how it is that we've been approaching that. And I think there are maybe, I'm trying to think which of the things are worth saying in the last 4 or 5 minutes. And let's cut to the chase. So what we have done is look at a bunch of different kinds of clustering, and they all have their own merits, self-organizing maps, and clustering of the sort that is a sort of phylogenetic correlation method that the Stanford group has devised. It's very good when you have small amounts of data. The statistical methods based on expectation maximization and certain other things start to get good when you have a lot of data. We know this from synthetic data and from developing a couple of metrics to compare with ground truth synthetic data. Hierarchical clustering of the statistical sort seems to us to pull out things that we would like. If you look at time courses,
could you describe the data that you're working with?
Yeah, the data that we're working with comes out of the kind of experiment that I showed you earlier. And so we're doing a time course of muscle differentiation here. We're doing this because we want to get more genes that we don't know about that are in the pathway. We want to find out if there are other regulators that are operating that haven't been found by the biochemical and genetic approaches, which we have some reasons to believe that there are. It's something where we know enough. It's not like knowing a synthetic ground truth, but it's kind of intermediate. We know a lot about some of the members and what they should do, and therefore it's a nice system for us to go in and test how both the data literally look for their data quality and what happens when we process them in different ways, what we can pull out. Number of genes in this experiment is about 8,500. We currently have two arrays that we're using, the co-array and what ultimately became the research genetics array. They're both for mouse. The co-array is stronger on embryogenesis, and that's about 15,000 in size. The two slides partially overlap. And so the data sets that I'm going to be showing you here are only from the research genetics array. When you do this hierarchically and trace where the muscle genes are, they start subdividing according to both their kinetics and probably because we're using a Euclidean metric according to the intensity of the induction. And so you see some things like this. That are these things are induced about 30-fold. And what I'm showing here are the mean vectors. The guys outlined in red are coming out of, at the top level, I believe there were originally six clusters. The number you see in each one of these things is the number of members out of the 8,000 that are came out of this top level cluster and coming down to the third tier, which was the last tier that was informationally instructive. And I'll show you in a second. The things coming out of these other things that are being stripped away and put into different subclusters indeed are things that are not of this class of muscle-induced genes that we would like to get rid of, but that were not shorn away in the first breakup of the data. This is being done by doing initially a cross-validation at each level in order to decide how many clusters one ought to try to fit at each level of the hierarchy. And if you look, this is the same kind of graph showing other of the vectors that were not carrying the muscle genes and were being set aside into other clusters. And they have various behaviors, including things that are going not very far. Another way to deal with those things, which we have played with, is generating a slack cluster. And so that's what's at, these are the kinetic courses that are actually sitting in each one of those groups. And you can evaluate to your own eye their relative homogeneity or non-homogeneity. This happens to be a 9-time point course, and one of the things that we got out of this when we graduated to a different kind of clustering, which is designed only for kinetics of RNA accumulation, where you do you permit two or three components and just base it on you do the clustering on the parameters that come out of each component, so the half time for decay and the synthesis rate, and then you cluster those. And so when we started doing that, that began to inform us that if we wanted to do that, 9 points was not nearly enough. So we've graduated to the 20-point time course, which is experimentally painful, but was driven by the fact that the kinetic clustering was doing a better job of giving us high resolution. And I'm not going to have time to go through it, but what happens is that you can begin to break down the genes that are the terminal genes from genes. This shows a little bit of it. These are the kinetics of that early regulator coming up itself, which is a party that's essentially over in about 12 hours. And up here are the nearest neighbors in a myogenic survey. And because of the way the chip was constructed to look for robustness in this, 8 out of 10 of those are the 8 spots that correspond to myogenin. It just tells us that we can reproduce them, and that we can find them and that they cluster and all that. But what we find is that the things that actually are the objects of the ministrations of myogenin, presumably as a positive regulator, come out and tend to come out with kinetics like this, which are much slower. And there's this 5-beta quality here that shoot up at the end, which seems to correspond to elevation of one of the MEL2 types ultimately. And so we can start to resolve what appears to be a dependency which initially is enough to get them going under the influence of myogenin, perhaps not actually forming that entire complex, or perhaps substituting one meth isoform that was already there for a new one that is somehow more effective and more profoundly effective. That's not kinetic resolution at the level that Uri will probably be showing it. Let me see. I think I'm trying to remember where this goes. This was for reference, and it was annoying. It's just where we are. Yeah, there is. Oh, don't do that to me. Go back. Oh, that's way too far back. Okay, I think what this is telling me is that indeed we are at the last slide, and we should probably be happy to be there. If I can get this slide up quickly, and bail into it. Let's just let it be at this level, even though it's not pretty. This is one last idea that I thought would be fun to leave you with, and that is how much of the so-called complexity and complexity conundrum presented by the big human genomes and big mouse genome is explicable, or should we look to be explicable, in terms of changes going on in this regulatory wiring and spaghetti. So probably the basic constellation of protein machines that actually make up different cell types is, one might guess, is not so radically different between a human and a Drosophila, and not even so radically different between a human and all the basal stuff that's in a yeast. And so recently there was much ado when the first genome analyses were published and announced, that derived from considering the fact that, we seem to have only about 35,000 genes, at least that are found at the level of the searches right now. And a fruit fly has about 13,000. A yeast, about 6,000. Coli, about 4,000, 4,300, or whatever the number is. So if you just look at the apparent simplicity or complexity of the two organisms, and were to think about it in some kind of linear world, people were becoming very upset. They just thought that humans ought to have more genes. Somehow the number 100,000 seemed to be less unsettling. Now, it's unclear to me why that's unsettling. I think when I found out you could build a Drosophila with all of its cell types and all of its capacity to do larval molts and complicated mating behaviors and everything else with something like twice as many genes as you can build a yeast. That, to me, if there's a conundrum, that's where the conundrum is. And so all that I mean to suggest and say is an interesting little fact that's emerged, not yet published, from the work, not of mine, but of a colleague who works at the Joint Genome Institute of the Department of Energy, named Lisa Stubbs. And she and her group have looked into a really marvelous study, and should be out in another couple of months. I would urge people interested in comparative genomics to look at it. And it's a study of human chromosome 19 and the several mouse regions that correspond to it. So it's broken up on several different mouse chromosomes. All that has been lined up, and now they've been put up against each other. And it's just a first pass look. But one of the interesting things that came out of it is that there is a family of zinc finger sequence-specific DNA binding proteins which have undergone massive change between human and mouse. Absolutely massive change. Change in number, but also a change right in the zinc fingers. It looks like the sequence just, and who knows what's really a coincidence, that sequence seems to be a highly changeable kind of sequence, seems to be encoded in a way that polymerase tends to fiddle with it. And so you've got many, many new genes, and they're expressed. Moreover, they're expressed in patterns that are different from each other. They're not all just duplicates that are being expressed where the family's been expanded. So if you're able to generate a few hundred new transcription factors, get them under different regulations so that they're expressed in different places, and have them change their target specificity or at least their affinity, it seems to me that although one doesn't know what their downstream target genes are, there is an enormous amount of difference between man and mouse that you can accommodate with a few changes like this without changing what myosin looks like and what actin looks like and all of those others. And so that's just by way of beginning to think about the evolution of the circuitry. One would certainly, ideally, like to know what all the new circuits are and how they relate to the quote-unquote old or shared circuits. So phylogenetic footprinting is definitely going to, you know, if you only care about that which is in common between us and pufferfish, then phylogenetic footprinting is wonderful, and that is stuff that we're willing to care about first. But there's a really interesting, complete other set of ideas that's almost inverse phylogenetic footprinting. I mean, wouldn't you like to know the differences that matter between humans and chimps? Most of us, I think, would just, you know, that would be really great. And there's a better than 98% overall sequence similarity if, again, you know, everybody places their bets differently and according to their own prejudices, but it seems to me that it's somewhat more likely that it is adjustments in the regulatory spaghetti that are, you know, just how much of something you express at a particular time that's more likely to explain differences between chimp and man than are the emergence of lots of whole new proteins. But some of this kind of thing, which is the expansion of a regulatory thing, is also there. So there's going to have to be a way to do discovery, which we hope is going to be able to feature those differences, identify those differences, and that may come from looking at more close-in species and focusing on differences instead of similarities. But it's not going to be trivial because there are those differences. Lunch.